On today's BizNews briefing, Donald Trump gets a Nobel Peace Prize nomination, South Africa's deep state uncorked, equity equivalence fueling a new patronage network, foreign missteps are driving away US investment, why export diversification is key, and Cathie Wood on Tesla, Meta, and Apple. Stay tuned. It's Wednesday, the 9th of July. I'm Stuart Lerman. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu met with Donald Trump in Washington, praising him as a peacemaker and even nominating him for a Nobel Peace Prize. Meanwhile, talks on a new Israeli-Hamas truce continue behind the scenes. Our partners at Bloomberg report.
Well, that's a very good point. Good morning, Jumana. It's worth noting this time there was no Oval Office meeting, at least not in the presence of journalists, which may be unusual. Instead, the leaders and their entourages had that dinner with a few grabbed remarks by press were allowed in, and they also met in private. So really, this meeting, despite the celebratory words, the warm words, the sense of optimism, it marks a work in progress. In parallel to that meeting, and the Israeli Prime Minister has other meetings lined up in the coming 3 days in Washington, there are envoys in Doha, in Qatar, one of the mediator countries, a country trying to mediate between Israel and Hamas, trying to hammer together yet another truce between Israel and Hamas that the president and other parties hope will lead to an end of the war. But there's a big question mark over whether that will happen, which may go some way to explaining why we have yet to have firm final statements on where this crisis is going from either leader in Washington.
Well, I think it's no secret that President Trump likes flattery, and it seems to be the case that the Israeli Prime Minister pulled out one of those gimmicks, I guess, or if, whatever you want to call it, but by presenting a letter suggesting that he had nominated President Trump for the Nobel Peace Prize. What was the objective of that done?
Well, it may well be sincere on the part of Israel, on the part of the Israeli government. They definitely see, certainly since October 7th, peacemaking through strength, through superior firepower, I think would be a way of characterizing the Israeli approach, and it appears to have been successful. They also are, as you noted, trying to stay well on side with President Trump, not least as having weighed in on Israel's side during the war with Iran last month. He's now signaling intention to re-enter talks with Iran, perhaps to achieve a nuclear deal with Iran. The Israelis would not necessarily rule this out, but they do want to know for sure that should Iran be suspected of using such talks as cover for an attempt to reconstitute its nuclear program, that the Israelis, perhaps with U.S. support, would be able to go back in militarily. So it would appear the Israelis are recognizing Trump as a peacemaker, as a potential peacemaker, while reminding him that war may remain the means, as far as they're concerned, for achieving an ultimate peace, if such is achievable in the Middle East.
From a potential truce up north to fireworks in the south. In the wake of the Mkhwanazi claims, political analyst Aubrey Matsike says South Africa's deep state is made up of rogue politicians, officials, and business figures, all competing to loot the state. He explains further on the SMWX YouTube channel.
What do I think is happening here? About a decade ago, I started talking about what I call the deep state. What is the deep state? The deep state comes into existence when there is a convergence of political, business, criminal, and intelligence interests in pursuit of the common goal of looting the state to make mountains of money.
Wow.
The deep state comes into being when politicians, senior government officials, rogue elements in the state and private sector intelligence sectors, rogue elements in business, big business, small business, and so on. Criminal syndicates work together in pursuit of a common goal of looting the state to make a lot of money. The thing, though, Hlubi, is that you almost never end up with a single deep state project. What you almost always end up with are several deep state projects.
Deep states.
Yes. So what then happens is that the different deep state projects come into competition and conflict with one another. And what happened in South Africa? Because of our political reality since 1994, of the single party dominance of the ANC, conflict between the different deep state projects manifested as factional conflicts in the ruling party.
From the deep state network to how the coffers are topped up, SARC-Lecha CEO Piet le Roux says BEE rules and so-called equity equivalence deals are blocking companies like Starlink and fueling a new patronage network. Le Roux sat down with Free Market Foundation CEO David Ansara.
What's happened to Starlink is striking because it's such a prominent company international, and Mr. Musk has his flair and tweets about it. But just multiply that by a million times, and that is the effect that is actually happening every day in South Africa through companies of much smaller scale with much less flashy products, but also of value add, of value adding capacity, which are now prohibited, restricted. So I'm afraid that, it's indicative what's happened to Mr. Musk. And interestingly, there seems to be some possibility that he may be offered, he and others like him may be offered what is called equity equivalence. That basically means instead of giving off ownership, you can pay for entry into the country in another way. You can just pay in cash or in some alternative kind of expense. I don't like that very much. I think that has actually been the case for many international companies, many prominent brands of automakers, of soft drinks and so on have made equity equivalent deals with the government, with Ibrahim Patel, with trade and industry over the last 10
often
years.
Their shareholder agreements prohibit them from ceding equity to local partners,
precisely.
For example.
Precisely. Yeah. Precisely. And so equity equivalence isn't a new thing. It's actually also not a great alternative. I would really like it if some of these international companies would push back also against equity equivalence, because it's still an entry tax. And now with these transformation funds being set up all around, even Mr. John Steenhuisen has signed off on some things explicitly called transformation funds. He didn't, perfect that he wasn't the first to establish them, but he continued his predecessor's policies. So even within this, the government, there's lots of staying power for these transformation funds. Minister Parks, Tower of Trade and Industry, now wants to put a new 100 billion rand fund there. We have some localization funds. And I'm just seeing a scenario here in which these equity equivalent schemes are being directed to fund these slush funds. And that creates a whole new separate patronage network that will take another 10, 20 years to disentangle. So these equity equivalent alternatives are a problem. I hope they don't stay.
Right now, you can get the cheapest Forex rate around, right here, on Shift. Pay less for your dollars, pounds, and euros here, and get to shop more here, and do more here, and enjoy more ooh-la-la here. Shift also lets you trade and transfer currencies and buy shares in the world's best companies. It all happens right here on Shift. You won't find a cheaper Forex rate anywhere else, no matter where you bank. Download the Shift app today.
At Sun Exchange, we make going solar simple, profitable, and completely risk-free. Join over 100 satisfied South African customers already enjoying the benefits of risk-free solar. Start saving today. Visit sunexchange.com and join the solar revolution.
Economist Becky Mahlobo says South Africa's foreign policy missteps, from BEE to backing Iran, drive away US investment and cost the country critical trade opportunities. He spoke to BizNews editor Alec Hogg.
America could indeed be a great friend. Let's draw on, for example, the BRICS summit that happened between the 6th as well as the 7th of July. America is a great friend to one of those countries, such as that of India. America contributes about 60% of foreign direct investment towards India, and South Africa could also have that relationship. That number there, Alec, could take South Africa's fixed investment level, which has been the consequence of the country seeing a 0.8% growth rate over the past decade, which sits at about 15%. That's the commitment by businesses to set up shop in South Africa and to invest in the country. That number sits about 15% as a proportion of GDP. Where it should be is about 25% if you look at other emerging markets, which is the norm. That's where the country should be. And in order to plug that gap from about 15% to 25%, you can attract American investments to the country that would lift the fixed investment number and, as a consequence of that, the GDP growth number. And in order to be a friend of the United States, the Americans have been quite clear on their three policy stances, which are non-negotiable from their perspective. I spent some time in Washington, D.C., speaking to people that have eyes on South Africa, and they've been crystal clear on what have been the issues in the country. The first one is that South Africa's empowerment policy, it's all well, and it's good for a sovereign nation like South Africa to have its own policies. However, what it should understand is that those policies have consequences. And from the American perspective, those policies are seen as a tax on investment, particularly South Africa's empowerment policy. Before they even commit and set up shop in the country, they tax a certain percentage of their board as well as their commitment in the country. The second part is if you look at the Expropriation Act, which allows for the expropriation of property, fixed or immovable assets, below market value. Say you were to buy a home, for example, in this beautiful place here in Johannesburg, worth about $2 million, and the government were to expropriate your property for about $1 million, gives you $1 million instead of your $2 million. That $1 million has indeed been expropriated, which makes South Africa uncompetitive on the global stage compared to other nations. This is not only the opinion of the Americans, but it's the opinion of other nations as well that looks at South Africa and sees that it's very difficult to commit investment here in the country. The third point, which the Americans have been crystal clear on, is South Africa's alliance with that of Iran, which it sees as a national security threat to itself as well as that of its allies. And perfectly aligning with that India example there is that if you were to look at India's comments in the BRICS summit, they did not go out their way as what Mr. Ramaphosa did by condemning the United States as well as Israel for what happened with the 12-day war towards Iran, but instead were very sensible in the way they approached that summit, said very sensible things that you were supposed to say in that committee. But the South African government, rather that of Cyril Ramaphosa, went out of its way, even beyond what the declaration of the BRICS summit was, to condemn the United States, in which the United States took that and didn't read it as well, resulting in South Africa seeing an additional 10% tariff hike from the 30%.
It's an interesting point you make there about the Iran relationship. It seems that our country should be, or Cyril should be, channeling his inner Modi from India, not his inner Khamenei from Iran, and just wake up to the reality of how the world is, perhaps not as he wants the world to be, because the potential, I guess, here is not just losing a friend, but if we lose that market, there's got to be some suffering.
South Africa is well within its right to form relations with any nation that it deems so. We can have relations with China. We can have relations with Russia. That's not the key concern for the Americans. The key concern for Americans is that we're closely aligning ourselves with a country that we're actually not getting, in terms of the hard numbers of economic performance, in terms of trade, with that of Iran. And again, there of India trades with everyone. It doesn't have hard chances in terms of its foreign policy. And with that, it allows investment from the United States to be committed within India. However, what we've seen towards the government, really within the South African government, is that they choose to double down on issues that are actually not winning positions. My read from this, Alec, is that the South African government moves at a very snail pace at addressing significant issues that it faces. Even if it is towards its detriment. About 10 years ago, when I started my career, it was told that if you don't fix the electricity situation, you will see high levels of load shedding in the country that will be detrimental to your governorship in local municipality elections in Gauteng, as well as that in the metros such as that of Johannesburg, as well as other metros around the country. It was also told as of last year that if you do not improve the material circumstances of the Africans, your number come election day would sit at about 40%, which was indeed the case. It continues to double down on these policy positions, even when it is towards its detriment. And you can also see that from the global stage, where it closely aligns itself with countries that do not have economic potential as well as that of beneficial for that of South Africa, compared to that of the United States, of which you've also started this conversation of, where we can actually enjoy a trade surplus. We've been enjoying a trade surplus with the United States since 2010, where our goods initially were not tariffed at 0% to where they currently stand at about 40%. There's grave consequences for that. But the catastrophic risk that I've seen some analysts suggest, I don't think that's largely going to be the case. South Africa will continue to be a low growth environment. And there's just that this will just be more of the case currently, given what has happened over the past week.
The full interview will be made available on BizNews TV on YouTube. AgBiz chief economist Wandile Sehlobo warns that ditching US agricultural trade for China isn't realistic. He says smart export diversification is key. He spoke to BizNews journalist Chris Stain.
Now, people have stated repeatedly that we should diversify, and there are many people who feel we should just tell the US to go, there's China. How realistic is that?
I mean, I hear, Chris, a lot of people would say, for example, you people in agriculture, why are you sweating about the 4%? Why can't you go to other markets and switch and look elsewhere in the world? But the reality is that there's a number of things there. One, we cannot just switch a market overnight and take up all of the things and go to the next market, because there's a supply chain dynamics and a relationship infrastructure and all of that that is built over the years so that you are able to export to one country. But the second aspect is also about whether the other markets really do have better terms of trade, better tariff arrangements. And I can tell you this, in China, talking to us that are in South African agriculture, we continue to face higher tariffs in China. If you are sitting in the Western Cape and thinking about exporting wine to China, you face tariffs of between 14 and 20%. If you are in Mpumalanga thinking about exporting macadamia to China, you face tariffs of about 12%. So switching to China is not as easy because we don't have also a trade agreement with China. And even if we were to have the trade agreement with China, I think that will involve a lot more of firstly dealing with the logistic and establishing the business dealings on that. Even if we were to go that path, the strategy that we are looking at as South African agriculture is rather export diversification on building and opening up as many export markets as we can. If you talk to anyone that is in the fruit industry, they will tell you that over the next couple of years, next 5 years or so, the South African fruit production will expand by plus 30% on just the trees that are already planted. Now, that produce will not be for the domestic market. We already export about half of what we produce in South Africa. So much of that produce will need to go to the export market. So the export diversification should continue, but not as a replacement to the US, but on building up the room so that much of the products that we will be producing will go to those new export markets. And I think the export diversification should be looked at in that way.
The full interview is available on BizNews TV on YouTube. Cathy Wood, through her company ARK Investment, manages approximately $60 billion. She says Elon Musk is far less distracted since stepping back from Doge, and also weighs in on Apple's talent troubles and Meta's AI play. Wood was on Bloomberg Surveillance.
Let's just talk about what Dan Ives said to us yesterday, that he believes Elon Musk is crossing a line and that the board needs to step in. Do you share that view?
Well, I have to tell you, we've been dealing with controversy around Elon Musk in one form or another since we first bought the stock when the company was founded in 2014. And we own Tesla in, it's one of the top holdings in three of our ETFs, so ARKK, W, and Q. So we are watching this like a hawk, no question about it. But with the experience over the last 11 years, we turn around today and see Tesla, really not an EV manufacturer anymore, moving into the robo-taxi age, we believe successfully, and we believe it will scale much better than most of its competitors. We see SpaceX really owning 90% of all of the satellites out there, Neuralink transforming lives of paralyzed people, people with ALS. And probably most surprising of all, XAI. Now, we own all of those, again, in our venture fund, following them very carefully. XAI is, on some benchmarks, it hit a point that O3 Pro hit in June. It hit it in February. So, you know, we are very focused on barriers to entry, technology, moats. And we believe that the moats that Elon has built, and obviously this is not just Elon, he's attracting the best and the brightest to help solve some of the world's biggest problems. So again, we do trust the board and the board's instincts here, and we stay out of politics.
Well, we'd love your opinion on the current situation, just on Tesla specifically. You mentioned some phenomenal companies doing some incredible things. For Tesla, though, do you believe that Elon can pursue his political ambitions at the same time pursuing the best interests of Tesla shareholders?
One of the announcements Elon made recently is that he is going to oversee sales in the U.S. and in Europe. And when he puts his mind on something, he usually gets the job done. So I think he's much less distracted now than he was, let's say, in the White House 24/7.
At what point do you see sort of the political landscape shifting, though, not just for Tesla, but for the haves and the have-nots in some of the big tech space? I know you've had a complicated relationship, say, with Apple, which seems uniquely pegged by some of these tariffs. Is there anything that you could see that would make you like that stock again? Or do you think that really it is going to fall out of Magnificent Seven?
Yes, we've been watching Apple for a long time with an AI lens. And that started, I'm going to say, about 7 years ago when it was becoming serious about autonomous vehicles. If you think about the ultimate mobile device, it's an autonomous vehicle, and that should have been Apple's to win. And what we've seen there is one turnover of management teams after another. And it's all around, you know, autonomous driving is an AI project. It's the largest AI project on Earth, we believe. And so losing the talent that it has, and as I understand, it lost another one today to Mark Zuckerberg's top 50. So they've had a lot of trouble in this regard. And I think the burden of proof is on them.
Do you think that it is time to follow the talent, that this is going to work, the gamble that you're seeing over at Meta, and that that's the path of travel for the other big tech companies that are going to just eat some of the companies from the inside out, take the talent, not necessarily buy the company?
You know, it's a very good question. We're trying to figure out if what Mark Zuckerberg is doing today is much like he did when he was pivoting hard to the metaverse, which proved because he thought that was the next big thing. And that was incorrect. AI is the next big thing, no question about it. And you do have to have the right DNA, and you have to move fast and break things, as he would say. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see if he's able to turn his open source strategy, and we've admired that quite a bit in terms of generative AI, into a leader again, or as we were observing it, Apple's Llama 3 at the time was improving at a faster rate than some of OpenAI's models. And that was true of open source generally. And then that has stopped. So yes, he had to do something. Is this the right thing? Why did that stop? I don't know.
Apple and Tesla are in the BizNews portfolios, and premium members get their seat at the monthly webinars hosted by my colleague, Alec Hogg. And that's it for today's show. A big thanks to the BizNews production team. From me, Stuart Lohman. Until next time.